The following is For Your Ears Only. I'm David Alpern.
I'm Melissa Axelberth, and we have newsmakers, experts, and top reporters to bring you these stories.
Two faces of terrorism as the U.S. searches for security flaws linked to the Boston Marathon bombing. Is it also increasing the likelihood of terror in Syria?
Surviving a nightmare. A psychologist considers rehabilitation for the Cleveland kidnap victims, the mind of their torturer, and other sexual abusers.
Good enough mothering. To mark Mother's Day, a psychotherapist's words of assurance and advice for beleaguered parents of both genders.
Catalyst for culture change. A new book explores the college killing that helped launch the Beat Generation and subsequent social revolution.
Rara avis, it means a rare bird in Latin. Actress singer Yana Avis is a rare treat in French, German, Spanish, English, and more.
Plus notable quotes from last week's news.
All that and more for your ears only, now a project of the nonprofit New York Foundation for the Arts. For Your Ears Only for the week of May 12th and Mother's Day, I'm David Alpern. Hi, Mom.
Hi, Mom, to mine, too. I'm Melissa Axelberth.
Since 2005, the GAO has sounded alarms about terrorist-related information sharing by placing it on its high-risk list. According to GAO, the federal government has made no substantial progress in developing a system to strengthen the sharing of intelligence, terrorism, law enforcement, and other information among all of its stakeholders, including federal, state, and local, tribal, international, and private sector partners.
I do think we'll be arming the opposition shortly. We're doing a lot more there on the ground than really is known.
America last week was fixated on two faces of terrorism. In House hearings, Republican Jeff Duncan of South Carolina focused on weaknesses of intelligence analysis and sharing that failed to adequately follow the radicalization of the Boston Marathon bombers after admittedly vague warnings from Russia and the trip to an Islamist area there by one of them, Tamerlan Tsarnaev. He died after a shootout with police and last week was secretly buried in Virginia after Boston area cemeteries refused.
Also last week, Republican Senator Bob Corker of Texas on CBS This Morning predicted a heightened level of U.S. military involvement in the Syrian civil war, where the estimated death toll of 70,000 often reflects terror tactics by both sides. Indeed, one United Nations source reported indications that rebels had used chemical weapons, perhaps in addition to government forces. And there was continuing controversy over the inadequate preparation for a deadly Islamic terror attack on the U.S. diplomatic facilities in Benghazi, Libya, on 9/11 last year, after the Obama administration helped overthrow the brutal dictatorship in that nation.
Newly public emails and diplomat survivors of that attack suggested that some administration officials later intervened to obscure the details in public statements, and some Republicans predicted that episode would doom any presidential ambitions of former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton. To consider all these developments for Your Ears Only, we're joined again by Dr. Michael Brenner, University of Pittsburgh Professor Emeritus and a fellow of the Center for Transatlantic Relations at Johns Hopkins. Welcome back to the program.
Well, good to be back with you.
You wrote last week about the emotion and confusion surrounding the term terrorism. Is there a basic definition on which we can agree?
No. It's not. Let me say two things. First, it's not that difficult, sort of, to define terrorism, but it is quite difficult to get agreement on it because the term terrorism is used not in a descriptive way, but in a way intended to sort of evoke certain kinds of images, certain kinds of emotions, and very often to serve political purposes.
We understand the terrorist motives and tactics of the original 9/11 attacks on Washington and the World Trade Center. But you say that from the viewpoint of civilian victims, U.S. foreign and military policy also has had terrorist connections, from Latin America and Vietnam to Iraq and Afghanistan. Give us an example.
Well, I mean, just look at Afghanistan. I mean, the United States sort of uses both special forces and well as drone strikes and actually some conventional combat military unions in ways that we know are going to produce civilian casualties. Now, that can be looked at in simply pragmatic terms and saying we're willing to accept those casualties and the cost to us in the way of image in terms of political influence on the ground in Afghanistan, because it's so important to us to get the bad guys we're primarily aiming at. Okay, but the people who were killed in those exercises, and they number in the thousands, and in Iraq they numbered more than that, you know, are just as dead. is a variation of it, I think, which raises more serious, even more serious sort of ethical questions. And that is an attempt to use violence against groups, against villages, against hamlets that are sort of suspected of providing aid and comfort to an insurgent force, and in effect we're trying to intimidate them to cease doing that. We did that on a massive scale in Vietnam and killed hundreds of thousands of people in that way, on a lesser scale in Afghanistan and Iraq, but there certainly are instances of that. So in other words, both sides, if we could put it that way, those insurgent groups that are using acts of terror against the population and those trying to counteract them are ready to employ violence to influence the behavior and the attitudes of innocent civilians on the ground.
Interestingly, a former State Department official last week called the use of drones illegal, unnecessary, and out of control. And in the current debate over more active involvement in Syria, I wonder what you think the likelihood is that rebel groups we aid or others they have to coordinate with will be guilty of civilian deaths and injuries that may be seen as terrorism, at least by their victims.
Well, the evidence we have is that this is occurring. The Assad regime has used violence on a very large scale and is responsible for most of the civilian casualties. But there are sort of credible reports that at least some elements among the, you know, the insurgents have also used violence against civilians, either in retaliation or because that particular community sort of provided active support to government forces. Because don't forget, there's also a strong sectarian element involved. But in that case, we have to understand that the opposition is not unified. It's simply a loose coalition of diverse groups and have different sectarian identities, different philosophies, different degrees of commitment to what we would consider to be reasonable political discourse, and big differences in what they expect as an outcome. Of course, that greatly constrains what any outside party can do, including us, because you don't know how aid and support that you provide is going to be used and what the eventual outcome is going to be.
We didn't have boots on the ground in the Libyan uprising, but still our civilians were targeted by some of the Islamist rebels who seized power after the Gaddafi regime fell. Is that a threat we'd have to be better prepared for in Syria if new Secretary of State John Kerry's latest diplomatic efforts fail and we turn to greater military involvement there?
Well, yes and no. I mean, I don't know anyone who really knows Syria, you know, as opposed to the sort of do-it-yourself experts who cluster around K Street and DuPont Circle in Washington, and whose expertise is based upon a weekly diet of hummus and tabbouleh from Whole Foods. I mean, people who really know Syria will tell you that, first of all, I mean, the situation is so complicated, and by the way, contrary to that long op-ed piece in the New York Times a couple of days, it's far more complicated than Iraq. Makes it extremely difficult to intervene, even politically to intervene, with confidence as to what the net effect of your intervention is going to be. The administration is not prepared to admit it because the American people generally find it difficult to absorb the notion that there are situations in the world that the United States is not indispensable to solving and simply is unable to resolve on terms satisfactory to us. So, I mean, if Libya produced certain outcomes that were undesired, like the appearance of some of these more radical Salafist militias, then that certainly is going to occur. They've already crystallized in Syria on a much more, you know, extensive basis. And that's simply the reality of the situation that we have to contend with.
Thank you, Doctor. Dr. Michael Brenner is University of Pittsburgh Professor Emeritus and a Fellow of the Center for Transatlantic Relations at Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies.
Quote from the news, absolutely inappropriate. That was IRS official Lois Lerner apologizing for special scrutiny of tax-exempt applications from groups with Patriot or Tea Party in their names. She denied political bias, but House Speaker John Boehner demanded more accountability.
Next, kidnap, abuse, and survival in Cleveland and beyond. For your ears only. We're back for Your Ears Only. I'm Melissa Axelberg.
I'm David Alpern with this quote from the news: enabling individuals to create their own sovereign space. That was the stated goal of Cody Wilson, creator of a working all-plastic gun that can be printed from files on the Internet. At Treasury Department request, Wilson's defense distributed firm deleted the data, but the files quickly appeared on the peer-to-peer Pirate Bay network. Now this.
911. Help me. I'm Amanda Berry.
You need police, fire, or ambulance?
I need police.
Okay, and what's going on there?
I've been kidnapped, and I've been missing for 10 years, and I'm here. I'm free now.
A 911 call in Cleveland last week marked the end of a 10-year nightmare for Amanda Berry and two other young women seized as girls and kept in dungeon-like conditions with ropes and chains and sexual abuse that produced one live daughter and reportedly nearly half a dozen pregnancies that ended in brutal beating-induced miscarriages. By the weekend, 52-year-old former school bus driver Ariel Castro was charged with 4 counts of kidnapping and 3 counts of rape, with more counts of homicide and a possible death sentence predicted because of the induced miscarriages. Castro reportedly confessed his uncontrollable sexual and violent urges to the police.
Such urges figured as well last week in reports of increased sexual abuse in the military, including the arrest on charges of sexual assault of the very Air Force officer who headed the Air Force Sex Assault Prevention Program. They were also a factor in the 4-month trial and final conviction of Jodi Arias for the fatal slashing and shooting of a boyfriend with whom she was obsessed, and despite her claim, he abused her. To talk about the psychology behind all these developments and prospects for recovery of the Cleveland kidnap victims, for Your Ears Only, we're joined again by Dr. Gregory Jantz, psychologist, addictions therapist, and author of When Your Teenager Becomes the Stranger in Your House. Welcome back to the program.
Good to be with you today. It's a difficult topic.
It is. Parents hate to think about their kids being abducted, much less talk to them about it, except for warning to beware of strangers. What is the best advice for a young person, or anyone really, on how to survive psychologically while being held captive and abused?
You know, there is a lot of work that's being done on this right now about survivor and survivor guilt. We've heard things even like Stockholm Syndrome, where you over-identify with the abuser. And as we look at this situation where there's been great torment, some beyond imagination, the recovery from this is slow at best. You know, a person loses their sense of self and their own identity. So that said, when you have something happen to you, you're held captive, it is so important that we don't give over our identity. Is that easy to say? Yes. Difficult to do? Absolutely.
What are the largest lingering psychological problems for a survivor of such kidnap and torture?
Some of the most difficult thing to overcome is the whole area of knowing who to trust, what is a healthy relationship, and the depression and post-traumatic stress that will follow. Even though this gal, they're free, there is also a lack of security. They were in an environment, as horrible as it was predictable, and there is so many hurdles for these gals to work through as far as normalizing what is a normal life.
What about the special case of the little 6-year-old daughter of one of the girls? I mean, that's the only life she knows. Is it somehow less painful for her because it didn't seem unnormal, or is it in fact just as distressing?
You know, just as distressing, what we don't know is the degree of sexual abuse on the 6-year-old. And earlier abuse to a person, they tend to develop more what we call dissociative disorder, where they really disconnect with reality in order to bear the enormity of the pain. We don't know. There's so much we don't know about this 6-year-old and what she had to endure.
And what are the best ways to help a survivor to the most successful rehabilitation? Should they be prompted to reveal, relive, and somehow diffuse the painful memories?
The painful memories, and a lot of times they're going to have memories that will follow them years to come. You know, there's even where we tend to suppress some of these things, and it comes out much later, and the vividness. This is where we're going to see, you know, even nightmares that can come years later. They've got to have the two needs of security and safety met. Whatever environment they're placed in, it's got to be a true environment of love and security. And they also need to move to a place where they begin to contribute in some way. in a positive way to something. This will be very important.
The Cleveland police said their records do not show any calls to the house from suspicious neighbors, which may just indicate a lack of departmental diligence. But people are often reluctant to report what they suspect is child abuse, especially by parents, on the grounds that shattering a family might be even worse. As a mental health professional, what do you say to that?
You know, we always want to err on the side of safety. And if you ever suspect, you know, we can make phone calls anonymously. But I'll tell you, the situations that we see are people who say, you know what, I thought something was wrong. And they didn't listen to themselves and later have great regret. If you suspect anything at all, always err on the side of safety.
Let's turn to the other big story of sex abuse in the military. There was a White House meeting on it last week and promised legislation in Congress this week. Is it your sense that the Pentagon's problem is far worse than in other militaries that mix men and women?
I don't know if it's far worse, but what we've been seeing through the years, particularly the last, probably increased last 5 years, is individuals who've been in the military who have come to us for help for post-traumatic stress that included sexual abuse and sexual issues that had happened to them. I think it's a greater problem than what we realize.
Do you think the problem within the U.S. Armed Forces will decline over time as male members become more used to what they may now see as encroachment by women, especially with more combat roles for them?
No, I think any time we mix two things together, time, so time spent together, and intensity of that time. So you do intense trainings, you're in the military, there's a lot of intensity. Where there's time plus intensity, there is always an increased probability for crossing sexual boundaries.
Can the problem be best reduced by more psychological awareness training or tougher, consistent discipline? Oh, and military court convictions that can't be overturned by commanding officers?
I think the boundaries have to be very clear and there's got to be serious consequences. Yes, that sends a message. Will it take care of the problem? In my estimation, it won't.
Finally, any thoughts on the psychology of Jodi Arias, who changed her story about the murder so many times, now says she'd rather die than face life in prison? Do you think she's really persuaded herself she killed in self-defense?
There reaches a point where we create such what I'll call a non-reality, where you believe the lies. We call that delusion. And there does reach a point where a person can be so delusional where they're believing their own lies. And even when they're taking things such as polygraphs, they have convinced themselves, even physiologically, which is interesting, of what the truth is. So you can distort reality so much that you begin to believe a non-reality.
Dr. Gregory Jantz is a psychologist, addictions therapist, and author of When Your Teenager Becomes the Stranger in Your House. His websites are drgregoryjantz.com and aplaceofhope.com.
Quote from the news, we're actually trying to be helpful. That was Texas Senator John Cornyn on 300 proposed Republican amendments to bipartisan immigration reform, many meant to increase border security, stall any path to citizenship demanded by Hispanic voters, or kill the bill entirely. At least many Democrats charge that.
Next, a Mother's Day memo for your ears only and your mom's.
We have more for Your Ears Only. I'm David Alpern.
I'm Melissa Axelberth with a quote from the news. Monday morning quarterbacking. That was West Texas Mayor Tommy Muska rejecting suggestions that death and devastation from last month's fertilizer plant blast resulted from inadequate regulation of the plant and residential expansion in the area. Other officials opened a criminal probe of the blast and arrested a first responder for possessing pipe bomb materials. Now this.
God's gift sent from above. One real unselfish love I found in my mother's eyes.
Mothers and motherhood have come a long way since that 1929 classic sung by young comic George Jessel in the film Lucky Boy. With all the countervailing options and pressures, what does being a good mother really mean today when so many women work full-time, then return to make home a home for kids and husbands? Does the goal of perfection impede realizing the good or good enough?
Good Enough Mothering is the title of a book by Dr. Elaine Hefner, a psychotherapist, senior lecturer of education psychiatry at Weill Cornell Medical College in New York, and blogger at goodenoughmothering.com. To elaborate this Mother's Day, for your ears only, Dr. Hefner is on the line now. Welcome to the program.
Well, I'm glad to be here.
Why advise women to focus on good enough mothering as opposed to perfection or as close to perfection as they can get?
One of the problems today is exactly that song that you just played. I don't mean the fact that you played it. I mean the sentiment in it, because we have an idealized image of motherhood, which is affecting everybody, the women who are professionals or who go to work just to supplement the family income, and especially mothers who are still trying to raise their children as a full-time job. And so this is a very misleading picture, because it suggests that always the part of that idealization is that children always come first, mother always puts the child ahead of her own needs, and generally the feeling of somebody who is just taking care of you and thinking only of you and your welfare, it's a very unrealistic idea, and certainly does not give children a realistic picture of how they're going to grow up in the world.
You point out that no matter what income level or fame a woman has, they're still conflicted about leaving their kids to go to work. Even someone like pop star Beyoncé, for whom money is no object. Talk about that.
I always tell mothers not to confuse feelings of guilt with reality, because the fact that you feel guilty doesn't mean you are guilty of anything. So I think that women, mothers, do feel guilty. As a father once said to me, guilt is not my thing. But it does seem to be mother's thing. And, you know, part of that, I'm sure, is biologically based. And the feeling of responsibility, children are dependent creatures, and we feel that we're supposed to take care of them. And it pulls at our heartstrings when we leave them to go off to work. And also, children contribute to that feeling, because lots of times they don't want you to go, and they might make a fuss. And so that sort of tells you that you're doing a bad thing. But that's not necessarily the case. So, you know, I think the difference between people who can really afford to provide very good child care and know that their child is well taken care of when they're gone, I think the situation is a lot easier for those people than for people for whom child care is a real issue. And I think it is a major issue in our society today, because it's one that we haven't solved.
To what degree is mothering more difficult because women get so little positive feedback on the way they do it, from husbands who don't notice if they're there at all, or from kids who so often want more freedom and less discipline than really may be good for them?
Well, I think what makes it difficult is that it is not being able to realistically appraise what you're doing for your child and whether it is really detrimental or positive. If you know, children's feedback is not always very useful, because they, you know, there's this whole idea of the good mother and the bad mother, which pervades all of the cultural thinking about women and mothers. You know, that's how, when you're a young child, when mother does what you want and is good to you, well, then she is the most wonderful person in the world. When she doesn't give you what you want or she frustrates you, then she's the wicked witch from the West. And so you know, children protest and they make us feel terrible, like we must have done something terrible to them. So I think part of keeping your perspective is not to be totally influenced by the kind of reaction you get. And if children are crying when you go off to work, and you may feel it pull at your heartstrings, but you also, if you know that they're being well taken care of, I think that is something that should provide reassurance.
Let's look at one of the recent postings on your website. It has to do with kids and the new technology, feeling guilty maybe about occupying them with iPads to keep them quiet versus really including them in adult conversation. Simply the fact that it's so easy for them to have kind of ersatz or artificial relationships online or with games as opposed to really interacting with real people. Where do you come down on that? Are we preparing them for the new era, or are we somehow isolating them?
Well, there are some people who think that we are helping their brains develop for the real world that they're going to be dealing with, and that's probably true. But the answer to your question, though, is I think really depends on the individual parent. If you want to plop your child down in front of the television set and leave them there for hours, well, obviously that's not the most constructive thing for the child's development or learning or anything else. So I think it's a question of all of these things, using them judiciously and, being mindful of bringing variety. The question of iPads, I think a lot of mothers might cringe at the idea that there are two iPads that can be popped out in a restaurant, which was the article that I think you're referring to, and given to each child. I think, then you get economic issues come into it as well. And I think part of the problem with some of this new technology, like the iPads and the iPhones and the iPods, and I don't even remember the names of all of them, is that kids begin to sort of feel entitled to them. And I know mothers have discussed with me the conflict they feel because it somehow is against their values or against their pocketbook to be able to spend that kind of money. And yet somehow they feel that children need to have what everybody else has. And that becomes a real stress.
Dr. Elaine Heffner is a psychotherapist, senior lecturer of education and psychiatry at Weill Cornell Medical College in New York, author of Good Enough Mothering, and blogger at goodenoughmothering.com.
Quote from the news, good news for girls, women, and their families. That was Stanford gynecology professor Paul Blumenthal on new price cuts for cancer vaccines in poor nations. Also last week, a new study suggested links between reduced heart disease and pet ownership, dogs in particular.
Next, Killer Culture Catalyst at Columbia, for your ears only. With more for your ears only, I'm Melissa Axelberth.
And I'm David Alpern with these quotes from the news. I am an imperfect man saved by God's grace. That was former South Carolina Governor Mark Sanford on his admitted adultery while ostensibly hiking the Appalachian Trail, which did not prevent him winning a congressional election against a Democrat who is the sister of Comedy Central star Stephen Colbert. And this, it's not a career issue for me, it is a long-term health issue. That was New Jersey Governor Chris Christie denying presidential aspirations were involved after disclosure he had surgery to fight his obvious weight problem. He's since lost 40 pounds. Now this.
In this story, Ginsburg comes to Columbia and he meets Lucien Carr. And they have this very like romantic, inspirational relationship that in the end, for Ginsburg, ends up, he becomes a poet and he finds out who he is as an artist. And for Lucien, he commits a murder and goes to jail. So that's like, that's it in a nutshell, I guess.
Actor Dane DeHaan at the Sundance Film Festival on a forthcoming film called Kill Your Darlings, and his role is Lucien Carr, the pretty boy at Columbia University who attracted and inspired a crew of self-styled booze and substance-stoked rebels who launched the Beat Generation and subsequent 60s cultural revolution. Their names are now iconic: poet Allen Ginsberg, dark novelist William Burroughs, and on-the-road writer Jack Kerouac.
Carr himself spent 2 years in a reformatory for that murder of an over-amorous teacher who'd followed him from St. Louis. Then he went remarkably straight, ending up in key posts at United Press International, where I called him my poet editor. Now his story and the larger history of artists he so motivated is told in the new book Mania, the story of the outraged and outrageous lives that launched a cultural revolution from top five books. And for your ears only, co-author Robert K.L. Collins joins us now. Welcome to the program.
Greetings from Seattle.
Talk about why and how young Carr so excited and energized the others in their creative pursuits.
The whole idea of Mania is the backstory of the great literary figures Kerouac, Ginsberg, and Burroughs. And right there at the hub is a man named Lucien Carr, who in 1944 was all the rage in New York at Columbia University. Some called him Angel Boy. Others called him devious demon. He was kind of all things to all people. He was very attractive. He was very bright. He knew the dark side of Nietzsche or the mystical side of Yeats. But he did have his bizarre side. Sometimes if he was feeling maniacal, for example, he'd chug Canadian Club whiskey. He'd then chew the shards of the cocktail glass and pick the sharp slivers between his bloody teeth. That tended to get people's attention. If he was feeling deviant, he'd urinate out the window.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, sure. Or if he was just feeling devilish, he'd rip up a Bible. Once he even put his head into an oven and turned on the gas. He told his therapist it was an art experiment. He was quite something. Men and women, old and young, chased after him. He loved the attention. Allen Ginsberg was totally charmed by him. He once referred to him as the most angelic-looking kid I've ever met. Romantically glorious is how Ginsberg described him.
How did the murder and Carr's incarceration affect those artists who had orbited around him?
Well, forgive me. I'm a law professor, so I have to be technical. He was never convicted of murder. He was a form of homicide, of course, manslaughter. But it was a quote-unquote an honor killing. He killed a man named David Kammer, who he'd known for many, many years. They had been involved. Something went awry in the summer of 44. I think what happened was that Kammer was just becoming too attached to Lucien Carr, and Jack Kerouac had no love for that David Kammer. And so one night on the banks of the Hudson at Riverside Park, Lucien Carr stabs David Kammer several times. Thereafter, William Burroughs and Jack Kerouac helped cover it up. And so the story of the Beats begins there with that tragic moment in August of 1944. And it's that story that really begins the whole episode of the Beats, which in turn would produce the 60s counterculture.
And there was also a fascination with crime and drugs, as much it seems for sheer defiance of society as for escape or enjoyment. Talk about the role in their social and literary equation played by Herbert Hunke, which rhymes with junkie, which was only one of his antisocial sidelines.
Herbert Hunke, what a character. Let me just back up a little bit. These kids from Harvard and Columbia, they were looking for another side of life, something different. They wanted that breakout moment. And in Herbert Hunke, they found it. Herbert Hunke was literally a junkie, William Burroughs said. He had all the habits you could possibly imagine. Some the lowlifers in New York called him the mayor of 42nd Street. The cops called him that little creep. He hung out in the in bars. He sold pot, benzedrine, and heroin. He also turned tricks wherever, in any toilet, public or otherwise, that he could. He was small and skinny. His skin was quite pale. His hair was greasy. His arms were just filled with scabs and needle tracks. And believe it or not, parasites and fungi grew on his body. But he was an incredible storyteller. And these bright and well-educated kids stood at his feet, kneeled at his feet, and listened to one story after another. And they were charmed. And that vision of the other side of life, the seedy side, the gritty side, the hard side, very much caught their imagination.
He was also actually the source of the term beat, which later named a generation. How did that happen?
Right. Yeah, with him it meant beat, like, you're down and out. You're at the end of your line. You're out of luck. There's no more. You know, you've crashed through below the floor. And it was that, you know, if you will, that side of life, that experience that very much informs portions of Allen Ginsberg's Howl. Certainly William Burroughs's writing, Junkie, which is almost patterned after Herbert Hunke. And then, to some extent, Jack Kerouac's On the Road. But these were the characters that, like Lucien Carr and Herbert Hunke, that very much informed these young literary figures.
Ronald K.L. Collins is co-author with David M. Scover of Mania, the story of the outraged and outrageous lives that launched a cultural revolution from Top 5 Books.
A quote from the news. unlawful debt collection abuses against tens of thousands of consumers. That was the charge by California Attorney General Kamala D. Harris against J.P. Morgan Chase for a flood of questionable lawsuits to collect overdue credit card debt. Also last week, a major California pension fund, one of the mega bank's top 50 shareholders, joined efforts pressing Chairman and CEO Jamie Dimon to give up one of his titles.
Next, Rara Avis, Yana Avis, a Paris-born singer in love with love, for your ears only. A last chorus for your ears only. I'm David Alpern.
I'm Melissa Axelberth with a quote from the news. In 2008, we changed the guard. In 2012, we guarded the change. That was Michael Blake, who ran the Obama campaign for minority voters, on new data showing an increase in black turnout last year, surpassing white turnout for the first time on record. Now this.
The night is like a lovely tune. Beware my foolish heart, how white the ever constant moon. Take care, my foolish heart.
Love is her favorite subject, purrs Paris-born actress and singer Yana Avis. I'm a romantic. What can I do? What she can do is sing about it, the highs and lows, yearnings and regrets in English, French, Spanish, Italian, and more, in a new show called In Love, In Love, at the Café Carlyle in Manhattan, two Thursdays and two Fridays in May.
The tall and tawny widow of rent car king Warren Avis tastefully teased male listeners and lounged limberly on her baby grand in an opening night performance whose audience included famous fans Liza Minnelli and classic film beauty Arlene Dahl. And to talk more about the show, her own life and loves, for your ears only, Yana Avis is on the line now. Welcome to our show. Bonjour. Bienvenue.
Bienvenue. Merci. Bonjour.
You trained at France's National Conservatory of Dramatic Arts and acted on stage and screen. What were some of your favorite roles?
My favorite role, there was not one. There were so many. But strangely enough, I graduated in the role of Bérénice from the classic author Jean Racine, and it was tragedy, but I love comedy, frankly.
Was singing always part of your career, or did it develop later?
Oh, no, I never sang before. I mean, that is before 20 years ago, but I was a stage actress and television and movie. I was just starting my career when I met my husband.
Well, we know you left acting after a real-life love story that included marrying Warren Avis. How did the two of you meet?
I was asked to do a one-day modeling in Acapulco for the backgammon tournament at the time, and it was in 79. And so that's how I met my husband. The day I arrived, the PR took me to see a house, somebody in the house. The man was not there. Everybody was at the sea, so we overlooked and saw the party going on by the ocean. And that was the house of Warren Avis. And then the next day we met, and that was that.
Did you two have a favorite love song or one that captures the essence of your relationship?
Well, the one that reminds me of the beginning of our relationship is the song from Saturday Night Fever, only because we would dance at sunset by the ocean on that song constantly. And so, but for him, it was a sentimental journey, because of the first song he heard after he came back from being a combat officer in the war.
How did you come to cabaret, which combines acting and singing in such a personal way?
Once I was married and was going fast following my husband, but I started missing terribly acting, and I went back to tap dancing, which I'd done in Paris, of course, and I started with Henri Letang, who was an extraordinary tap dancer, and there was a lady who would coach the young Broadway kids how to sing or to develop their talent. Of course, I had no singing talent at the time, but I was drawn to it, and then I was taken to a very famous musical director who who told me about everything, like Eliza Doolittle in Pygmalion, you know. Yeah, he didn't put marble in my mouth, but that's about the only difference. And that's how I trained to become not a singer, but let's say an entertainer.
The first song in your new show, Look Me Over Closely, was written for the great Marlene Dietrich. Was that why you chose it? Is she something of a role model for you?
She definitely is, but the reason I chose it is because all the material that Friedrich Hollander wrote for her fascinates me, and they are all the songs that I adore. So I took one because this one is not that known. It comes from the film A Foreign Affair. So that's why I chose it. First, I loved it, and secondly, it was not one of the great, great known songs of Marlene Dietrich, which I do not want to choose. You know, for good reason.
Another of Dietrich's great fans was the playwright, composer, singer, director, and wit Noel Coward. He introduced her once with a poem that ended, "Now we all might enjoy seeing Helen of Troy as a gay cabaret entertainer, but I doubt that she could be one quarter as good as our legendary, lovely Marlena." And Coward also has a connection to the second song in your new show from a musical version of his comedy Blithe Spirit. Talk about choosing that one.
Actually, you know, I never knew where this song came from, to tell you the truth. It's only that at some point, a couple of years ago, the bass player that was playing with me, David Fink, said, you know, you should sing that song, You'd Better Love Me. And I like the idea, You'd Better Love Me, before I go, no, I may disappear. And that's the only reason, but you gave me some information I did not know.
It's from the show High Spirits, which was the musical version of Blithe Spirit. And so
yes.
A last question. Does having celebrities like Liza Minnelli and Arlene Dahl in the audience, do you find it a little intimidating, or does it raise your level of performance?
In the case of Arlene Dahl, I'm lucky to count her as a friend. It would more challenge me and stimulate me, but in the case of Miss Liza, it did intimidate me a lot. Yes, it did.
Yana Avis sings In Love, In Love at 10:45 p.m. May 9th, 10th, 16th, and 17th at the Cafe Carlisle, 35 East 76th Street in Manhattan.
It's love, this time it's love, my foolish heart.
And this has been For Your Ears Only. For Your Ears Only On Air is also online at iTunes, YouTube, FeedBurner.com, and the Stitcher.com app for mobile devices. But to continue, we really need your tax-deductible donation. Please pledge to davidearsonly@gmail.com.
This broadcast was engineered by Chad Dugatz at the Hangar Studio Play It Productions with interns Sarah Skirmont and Justin Griffith. I'm Melissa Axelberg.
Our show is a nonprofit project of the New York Foundation for the Arts with support from the Gatewave.org Radio Reading Service for those with disabilities and award-winning ACAM Associates, exceptional management, impeccable reputation, for New York co-ops, condos, and condops since 1983. Learn more at ACAM.com. I'm David Alpern.
Now we're back with another archive segment, a major story on our show a year ago. I'm Justin Griffith. This week, last year, we heard predictions that painful austerity measures in Europe were coming to an end and that the U.S. economy was headed for a rebound. From our May 13th, 2012 broadcast, hosted by Melissa and David.
Je mesure aussi que l'Europe nous regarde.
Europe is looking at us. And when the result was made public, I'm sure that in many countries in Europe, it was relief, hope, the idea that at last austerity would no longer be seen as unavoidable.
Socialist leader François Hollande was reflecting more than the usual political ego last week after his election as president of France. All across the financially troubled Eurozone, voters have been rising up against elected officials who march too obediently to austerity commands coming out of thriving Germany. But the opposition of democracy to austerity leaves some analysts worried about a major European collapse that could drag the U.S. economy back down with it.
To consider that possibility, a $2 billion trading loss by the biggest U.S. bank, J.P. Morgan Chase, and the state of the U.S. economy generally, for your ears only, we're joined again by Daniel Gross, economics editor and columnist at Yahoo Finance. His new book is Better, Stronger, Faster, The Myth of American Decline and the Rise of a New Economy from Free Press. Welcome back to our show.
Hey, it's good to be here.
For all the initial worries, Wall Street took the anti-austerity results of elections in France and Greece last weekend with relative resilience.
Yeah, I think, you know, in the case of Greece, we've already assumed for a long time that it's a basket case, that things will never get better there. They've written off a good chunk of their debt. There's probably a lot more to come, and everybody's been taking evasive action about Greece for a couple of years now. And with France, with the socialist elected president, there's the sense that maybe the mood has changed. Instead of doing this austerity, which has been self-defeating and only led to lower economic growth and more financial crises, that there will now be a force at the heart of Europe saying, let's look for something that's a little more expansionary. Let's try to get growth going, because in the long term, growth is the only solution to the problem of unemployment and budget deficits.
And there were reports that the German leader Angela Merkel might meet Hollande with some willingness to compromise, if not on the extent of austerity Germany requires to keep supporting financial relief, at least on the time span for it.
Merkel and Sarkozy were really of one mind, so much so that they were referred to as, you know, Merkozy, as if they were like Brangelina at the heart of Europe. We're not going to see a similar mind meld between the two. And I think she looks around and sees that in all these other countries in Europe, the politicians who have implemented austerity have all been voted out of office. We've seen changes in Ireland. David Cameron's not looking so hot in the UK, in Italy. And so it's clear the public is kind of revolting against us, which makes it harder to continue imposing that. And I think, again, that the election in France has really solidified that maybe it's time to think about a slightly different tack. Not that Merkel is suddenly going to come out and say, hey, let's stimulate the economies like crazy, but she has to realize the new political realities.
Barring total chaos, a Greek word, you note, Eurozone financial woes actually work in America's favor, continuing to draw foreign investment to U.S. stocks and government bonds with lower borrowing costs for our Treasury, right?
Whenever something bad happens in the world, people rush to buy U.S. government debt. Even though people were talking about a default, even though our political system is dysfunctional, it's the safest, most liquid asset around. And so we saw the yield on the 10-year bonds up to 1.8%, which means that the government can borrow for very cheap, but ultimately homeowners can borrow for more cheaply and companies. So they're going to go out and refinance their debt, make their profits look a little better. And this is one of the reasons I talk about it in my book about why the U.S. may not be in such decline. If everybody keeps turning to us for a safe haven, that really redounds to our benefit.
But also that your book says they're turning to us for our products, rapidly expanding exports. Give us some numbers on that.
So exports started to turn up in April 2009. They hit bottom, $124 billion a month. They've risen on a monthly basis by 50%. We just got the exports numbers for March, $186 billion. So I like to say, you know, we don't make anything the world wants except $186 billion in agricultural products, planes, machines, and services, tourism, higher education. When people from abroad come here and spend money, that's an export. And as the rest of the world has grown richer, they are showing a willingness and desire to buy what we're selling, whether it's at home or whether they come here to do it.
But there's also entertainment, the movies, the television, the arts that we put out.
People are concerned about the prospects for growth in the U.S. If the domestic economy is only growing 2% and you're saturated here, how do you get growth as a company or an industry? And the answer is to get more involved in overseas markets. You know, the Avengers, that movie that just opened, had a blockbuster first weekend in the U.S. doing $160 million. But it opened up overseas on April 25th and had already done $450 million overseas. Our business models, our products, whether it's Hannah Montana CDs or movies, Starbucks, they travel remarkably well. And in these past few years, when we've been sort of down on the U.S., a lot of these companies and products have really made great inroads into these very large markets overseas where people are, for the first time, having the cash to consume like middle-class people.
The improved state of American business is less obvious in the slow pace of job growth and not at all in wages. You also fault U.S. banks for hoarding record sums since they got big federal bailouts when the economy needs that money to grow. And the banks have been very embarrassed this past week by the situation at J.P. Morgan Chase, where they apparently lost $2 billion in trading that was meant to serve as a hedge against other potential losses. Are you seeing a return to push for more regulation and oversight?
Well, you know, J.P. Morgan Chase was supposed to be the smart bank. Jamie Dimon was supposed to be the smart banker. And the book about him was called Last Man Standing because he was the only institution through the financial crisis intact. And what we saw, this $2 billion loss that materialized on some complex products, really, I think, shakes the confidence in investors in Dimon and should make us think twice about the safety of our banking system. But it also really, gives the lie to this argument that the banks don't need regulation, that they're fine and, you know, they've learned their lesson, they manage their own risk, they have all the incentives to do so. The reality is they take money, they take it from depositors, they take it from the Federal Reserve, it costs virtually nothing. And in ways big and small, they continue to gamble with it. And as long as we continue to be implicated in that, insuring deposits, insuring their debt, and being the sort of last stop when they get into real trouble, we as citizens and as a government should have a real interest in what they do, which argues for more regulation rather than less.
Beyond regulation and oversight, are there incentives to lending that might be tried, especially in the area of mortgages, but others as well? We know rates are at a record low, but it still seems to be so hard for many people to negotiate or renegotiate their terms.
We're at a stage in the recovery where companies of all types, whether it's McDonald's paying more wages, companies paying more dividends, banks being a little looser with credit, they've restored their balance sheets. They have record profits. The U.S. corporate sector had corporate profits of $1.9 trillion in 2011. They've got to give that up a little bit.
Daniel Gross is economics editor and columnist at Yahoo Finance. His new book is Better, Stronger, Faster, The Myth of American Decline and the Rise of a New Economy from Free Press.
Eurodoubt's American Myths from our May 13, 2012 broadcast. Supporting the optimism of Dan Gross, the Dow Jones average last week enjoyed five straight days of gain and still closed above the recent record of 15,000. Indications of an imminent end to austerity in Europe continue, but at least as rhetorical as real. We're witnessing the end of the dogma of austerity, the French finance minister said. It has reached its limits, added the president of the European Commission. But concrete action has been largely limited to giving some countries more time to reduce their budget deficits. I'm Justin Griffith. We'll visit the archive again next week. Now, more from Yana Avis with her native France very much in mind.
Paris, je me retire à la campagne. L'ennui me gagne à cette champagne. J'en ai assez d'aller souper avec des poules et de rentrer comme si le pavé faisait de la houle. Adieu Paris, car j'en ai marre de sous la tête. Faire la fête, pas que ça m'embête. Je vais me mettre au vert, vivre comme des bêtes, me coucher tôt. Avant que je te quitte, que je vive en ermite, tout là-bas loin de toi, oh vite t'émerveille, encore une fois, buvons une bouteille, et puis trois. Oh la drôle de chose, des cabochons explosent, je vois la vie en rose, profitons-en garçon, apportez-moi la carte, il faut sans façon faire avant que je parte un bon gueule. Adieu Paris, ville de rêve et d'épouvante, ville méchante, ville charmante. Tu fais payer bien cher le bonheur que tu donnes, mais en mourant on t'aime tant qu'on te pardonne. Adieu Paris, adieu mon monde.